Well may we say, God save the Queen, because nothing will save the Governor General.
You know I've searched my heart to prove there's better ways to push and pull. Hey, whatever gets you through these days.
Welcome to Well May We Say, a progressive podcast about Australian politics. This is episode 17 for Friday, 24th of March, 2017. I'm Jeremy Sear, and each week I'll be joined by a different guest host to help me look into what's happening to our country and why, what's going to happen and what we can do about it. And tonight's guest host is a friend of the podcast and returning guest. Well, you weren't the host last time. You were sort of in an interim episode, Damien O'Mara.
Hi, Well May We Sayers. That's actually a mouthful, isn't it?
Well, at least you got it right.
Yeah.
Carl insisted on calling it All May We Say.
Oh, yes, yes.
I assume that was shade.
Oh, a bit of shade.
Yeah.
You need a grab of Alyssa Edwards going, shade. This might not be a quote that you get.
I don't know who that is. Is that like a...
RuPaul's.
I was going to guess, yeah. RuPaul's. Okay, righto. Friends of the podcast... Oh, listeners of the podcast from back in the Something Wonky days may recall Jacob, our original editor, who is Damien's husband. So there's a family connection here.
There is a family connection. Although, you know, last week you had acclaimed comedian, MC, commentator, etc., etc., Tom Ballard. This week you've got some guy. So it's pretty exciting.
No, we have Tom Ballard as well. We've got a stuck in my craw.
That's true.
But no, everybody enjoyed your episode. I'm speaking for everybody, by the way. I do that now. They appointed me to do it. There's an election.
Borg, you're a collective.
Incredibly like the Borg. I'm famous for it. People are always saying, wait a minute, was that Jeremy or the Borg? I keep on disparaging resistance. That's why.
Yes.
I keep on saying there's things wrong with resistance. Anyway, that's got nothing to do with this podcast. But somebody who has been facing a bit of resistance is our Prime Minister.
Yes, he's been facing quite a lot of resistance.
Mr. Trumbull, not beloved by anybody. And look, I know there's people on the right who think he's beloved by the ABC, but I don't really see much evidence of that anymore, even.
Yeah, because he's too right for the left and he's too left for the right, and he's sort of struggling to find a place in the middle.
He's trying to be all things to all people.
Yeah, and then you don't please anyone.
No. And this week he tried to... Because, look, I even tried... Just part of my general having an idea what's going on in the world, I listened to the Sky News podcast, and that was unfortunate. And then, because I'm trying to get in the mindset of, say, The Australian, where that's considered balanced, I went to far right. So I went to the one that George Christensen likes, which Cam Smith turns out to be completely right. They are literally Nazis. Like, they literally worry about white children not having enough other white children around them. Like, they're that far... They're mad. But they are convinced that Malcolm Turnbull is a filthy leftist who's only kept in check and kept moderate by virtue of the... What you and I might describe as the far-right loons around him.
Yeah. I mean, you almost feel bad for him, except that everything that's happening is just... so awful and, well, nothing. Like, really, like, if we're honest.
No, I don't feel bad for people who things go badly for them after they sell out the vulnerable.
Yeah, well, yeah, that's right.
If he's happy to, like, say things were going well for him after selling out the vulnerable, surely that'd be worse. Like, I'm glad that there are some consequences.
You're right. But still.
So he's had two things that he's sort of, well, that he's having some trouble with, because he's trying to clear the air. He wanted to talk about energy. So he sort of mentioned the snowy thing and then sort of moved on. After we sort of realised, hang on a second, there's a number of things you haven't done with that, and that's not going to increase energy generation, and it's, you also like sort of sprung it on the country, and you didn't, you may have talked with the New South Wales Premier, but you didn't bother talking to the Victorians. Although Peter Credlin's excuse for that is, well, he couldn't tell Daniel Andrews because then Daniel Andrews would have spoiled his thunder.
Did you listen to the multicultural statement?
No.
So, and look, this isn't his fault. He tried to go off the cuff and he failed. But he was talking about the snowy hydro and how it created jobs when it first came about for migrants. It was a great...
Yes.
And so he's giving his multicultural statement and he's sort of leading with this thing. And then he tries to connect it to jobs for migrants now. It's not a thing. And it just... It was this moment of trying to, in the multicultural statement in itself, and we'll get to something that kind of threw that off in a second, but the multicultural statement itself was quite good. It made good it talked about Australia as a culturally diverse nation, and that's our power, that's our diversity, that's how we are quite a successful nation economically, because we have this very diverse workforce and people work together and innovate and all of those things, and that's great. But at the beginning, he just tried to make a connection that didn't exist.
No, I don't think that's what this program would do, is it? There's no connection between his snowy plan and they're not.
No, there's prioritizing. Not. Well, that was the problem, though, because he was trying to milk the snowy for just another day.
Well, that's how they do it. They're like they it's almost like now they everything they say, this particular government in particular, and what was he coming out the other day? He wasn't talking about fake news. He was saying, I can't remember, he started adopting Trumpisms. Like, and I know, I've seriously seen him up there saying, believe me.
Oh, God.
Yeah, that's right. Anybody who's saying, believe me, is lying to you. They are a shonky salesman. And, it is astonishing how often, of course, Trump says, believe me.
Now I'm worried I'm going to say, believe me, during this podcast.
Oh, look, believe me, I will call you out on it. It's bonkers. But, we had Tudge the other week with the Centrelink stuff saying, no, there's no... the rate times are really short. Now, of course, and the other thing came out this week about is how Centrelink does those numbers by the way they count calls that get hung up on calls that get redirected as a successful one and something that's quick when it's not actually resolved or finished, when they just move it to one other section. There's a whole lot of shonky things about when they say calls are answered. Oh, and they also do that their average, the figure that they give for how quickly calls are answered is the average over the entire organization with all those dodgy counts, but it's not necessarily one for, say, Newstart. So the people who are ringing up, the Newstart line is much longer than the other lines, for example, and they try to average it in with the other ones. In the same way as whenever they talk about the vast cost of the welfare bill, they mean they're counting in everything to get that to get the number up. Like, and if you're looking at the full numbers that they're using that when they say welfare costs this much, the vast majority of that is the pension, not Centrelink. Not Newstart, not the disability support pension. Like they know that when they say welfare, people are thinking of unemployment benefit. They think they're thinking of Newstart, and they pretend that that's a huge expense, but it's a tiny percentage and a tiny proportion of the total welfare bill. But they try and fudge them together, so you think that the amount we're giving to the unemployed is huge when it's tiny. Like it's really misleading. But I've gone off on a tangent again.
Yeah.
You've got Turnbull saying, trust me, this is going to be something. It's about immigrants. And we had Hunt this week on the Sky. See, I really need to stop listening to right wing podcasts. On the Sky News one, talking about how they have a rock solid commitment to Medicare. You're like, what does that even? Like, okay, you're using words that sound reassuring, but I don't know that. Like, you're not committed to Medicare. Like, everybody who's been to a doctor knows how hard it's increasingly difficult to find. You come out there and you say bulk billing rates are increasing. Well, if they are, they're not increasing at the rate of population growth or something, because it is obvious that, like, everybody who's been to the doctor knows how difficult it is to find a bulk billing doctor now.
Yeah, absolutely. Even when you're not bulk billing, I go to a doctor that bulk bills, but I don't bulk bill because I'm very lucky and I don't need to.
Well, I don't know about that. Like, I don't like the idea of about wealthy people being hived off from public services. I actually think it's important for everyone to use public services, but wealthy people to be taxed enough to fund them. But I don't like the idea of the more people who pull out of the public system and go off on their own, the more you create a two-tier system, which ultimately ends up damaging the public system.
Context of the current system.
Yeah.
And so I had to get a mole cut out this week. Not very exciting. It's, I assume, completely benign. They said, oh, that's probably benign. Off track. I had to wait to get into the closest clinic to me, which bulk bills, but I was paying, I was getting a rebate, but not the full bulk billing. I had to wait 3 weeks to get in to see a mole specialist.
And that mole might have been serious.
Yeah, 3 weeks. And that was, I could have paid to go to private and would have if it was urgent enough, but the doctor said it's probably urgent.
Who can't?
Precisely. I'm in this really privileged position that if it was urgent, I could find a way to deal with it and I'd be fine. And as a big decision, it's not really going to affect my hip pocket in any meaningful way. But for some people, you know, you go, oh, it's a 3-week wait and this is really urgent. And so their option is, oh, I better go either to an emergency room or for something that you could probably go to a doctor for a day surgery for, because it's the only way to get it dealt with quickly. You know, you're clogging up other parts of the system. We are so off track.
Yeah. Well, the point of that is, the more adamantly the more clear the language they use claiming that they are in favor of something or that they're behind something, the more that it's now just reached a point where I'm immediately hearing the opposite. Like, I no longer even hear, like, him saying, I have a rock solid commitment to Medicare. I'm hearing, we're letting it die. Like, it's like, well, yeah. It's a classic, like, the US minister thing. Like, when you're doing, you know, if you've got things to announce, you say or you show or you demonstrate the opposite of what you're actually doing. And that's very much what their strategy.
Well, and this is the thing, is that we've somehow moved, well, not somehow, we've moved away from a substantive policy discussion. So a rock solid commitment to Medicare, great statement. Follow that up with, we are doing X, Y, and Z in order to ensure Medicare keeps meeting the needs of the Australian public.
He does it. And he says, oh, we've been able to put all these new medications on the PBS by reining in spending elsewhere in the system. And this is their big line. And we'll, you see that in relation to the childcare thing. We'll talk more about what's happened with childcare next week, because it's fresh and it's a little bit, it hasn't had time to percolate what exactly is happening with it. But this line that the Libs have of we are cutting funding to these things. We're starving. We're making young people wait 4 weeks for the dole. But it's to protect, protect the system for young people in the long term, and so they don't have to pay off this huge debt. Like, they present the only way to get these medications onto the PBS is to cut other things out of the PBS for savings. Well, no, that isn't the only way. You could support young people properly now without adding to the debt by raising revenue appropriately. You could add things to the PBS without cutting other things off the PBS by raising revenue. Or, in fact, and when I say raising revenue, restoring revenue to the way it was in 2004. We don't... It is astonishing to me how much... And this is a response to anybody who's telling me that the media are leftist. How many political journalists, whenever this line is given to them, that, you know, we've got to find savings, we've got to cut this spending so that we can spend on other things, how many of them say, or reduce the debt, how many journalists come back and say, we could just undo the revenue cuts?
You're absolutely right. And I think this is something that's really been a sticking point for a lot of people, because we have these middle-class tax cuts that have just been held onto for such a long time, but are also viewed now as something people are owed, that people believe that, oh no, this is, if you raise my taxes, that's a bad thing. They were cut because we were in a boom. We're not in a boom anymore. Like, the response to that is to say, well, this is what it was like then, this is what it's like now.
It's the ratchet. If it's a boom, you cut taxes. If it's not a boom, you cut spending. And then it's like, always...
Full disclosure, I think cutting taxes during a boom was a stupid move.
Of course it was. I'm not saying they should. I'm saying that's what they do. Like, when there's a boom, they don't say, oh, good, we've got this extra money, we'll save it. Or, we've got this extra money, we'll spend it on infrastructure.
Invest in things that we need.
Yeah. No, what they say is, oh, good, we'll give the extra money back to the richest people in the country through tax cuts.
Yeah.
And then when that's no longer sustainable, they don't say, okay, well, that's got to stop now, back to the way we were. They say, oh, well, we don't have the money now, we'll just have to kick the poor harder. That's the ratchet. Like, it's always in one direction.
Yeah.
But look, let's get on to it, because talking of getting off topic, we've lost the main theme of tonight. I was talking about the stuff that Trumbull doesn't want to deal with.
Yeah.
And there have been two big issues this week that are relating to that. And one is 18C and one is the marriage equality debate coming back. And look, these are definitely things that we have talked about on this podcast before. But, you know, it turns out that we didn't fix them. And they still appear to be issues that are clogging up the public debate, and, you know, in a way that perhaps Malcolm Turnbull doesn't want them to, although, frankly, it's not like there are any other great issues for Malcolm Turnbull at the moment anyway.
Can we just start with...
18C?
Well, 18C, but...
Which is an idiotic thing for us to be talking about, except it's actually... They've actually announced that they are actually changing it.
On Harmony Day. And...
What is Harmony Day?
So Harmony Day is a government initiative.
Australian government.
Federal government initiative.
Right.
21st of March every year, and sometimes gazetted to, like, Monday so that schools can do it, because lots of schools do it. but it is about celebrating the cultural diversity of Australia as something that makes Australia great. And all around Australia, particularly in government and schools, which are government, but in these institutions that we all view as really important, there are kids dressed in cultural costume or sharing where their family comes from, talking about how they came to be in Australia. And the whole idea is of Harmony Day is that, with the exception of the First Peoples of Australia, we all have a migrant story to tell, and we should be sharing that. You know, we all belong here. On that day, they decided to announce the weakening of racial discrimination laws.
Well, according to Turnbull, it strengthens them by making them stronger, which is insane. And again, another one of these, what he says is the opposite of what he means. Like, for him, like, there's a reason why his backbench has been fighting, and the Australian have been fighting hard for it. It's because they don't like the idea that a bunch of white people say, like, they're two big examples.
So, and from people I've heard from on this topic, and I am not an expert on law or anything like that, but I've heard from people on this topic, and there are two sort of schools of thought. One is that it does weaken it, and two is that it might not make a substantive difference, but why the hell are we talking about this so much? I believe that it weakens the racial discrimination.
So what's the change? The change is they're going to... So currently, 18C says that it's unlawful to engage in acts that are reasonably likely to offend, insult, humiliate, or intimidate somebody because of their race or ethnicity. And the government's proposal is to take out offend, insult, and humiliate and replace it with harass. So it'll be, you can't engage in acts that are reasonably likely to harass and intimidate.
So my first point would be, how has it actually been interpreted at a judicial level?
The word harass?
No, the intend, insult, or humiliate.
Oh, offend. Yeah, well, I'm assuming that the reason why it's offend, insult, and humiliate is because if you had, like, what they mean is harm. They mean has this conduct harmed these groups? And I would argue that, for example, in the case of Leak, of course it did. You can't be putting out stuff constantly describing Aboriginal people as wife beaters, and that's what their culture is. Like, he would put out a cartoon being with a beaten Aboriginal woman and an Aboriginal man saying, oh, well, you give her Sheila's, you give them a cultural experience and what thanks do you get? Like, that Aboriginal culture is about abusing women. That is the line of that cartoon. That is, you put that stuff out there. You put out the thing saying, he should take some responsibility for your son. Yeah, righto, what's his name then? Suggesting that Aboriginal fathers are so subhuman they don't know their own children's name. Like, you can't be putting that stuff out there and it not be causing genuine harm to Aboriginal people as they interact in the community.
And in particular, the Aboriginal children that he's espousing to support in this comedy sort of approach to the world. And do you know, I'm pretty easygoing when it comes to comedy. I don't think so,
because you're gay, and as I understand it from Bill Leak cartoons, gay people are Nazis.
Well, we are. It's true.
Literally Nazis. Like, they jackboot and have, like you march like Nazis. It says so in his cartoons.
I've seen Mardi Gras.
It was respectful.
All
he was suggesting is that when LGBTI people fight to be treated equally under the law, what they're actually doing is murdering Christians.
And the fundamentals of Bill Leak are that freedom of speech is great unless it's criticising his freedom of speech.
Yes.
It is, for him and for his supporters and for so many people on the right, it is a one-way street, because they view criticism of freedom of speech, criticism of your ideas, criticism of what you're saying that offends, humiliates, harms my community, harms the Indigenous community, harms culturally diverse communities, as being shut down. And it's like, it's only shut down if you think that what I say is shutting you down, because what I'm saying has more gravity than what you're saying. I'm saying what you're doing is wrong, and you at some level must recognize it's wrong, and therefore it's an affront to your free speech because you feel a bit bad, or you feel like everyone yelling at you is not free speech. But that's free speech. Sorry, I'm doing giant hand gestures because it just drives me nuts that it's a one-way street.
It's powerful people who are used to not having to consider the impact of their words on other people. because it doesn't affect them and they don't have any sympathy. It's like the, what was the Kathy Wilcox cartoon today? It was a dark-skinned person saying, I'm paraphrasing because I've got it in front of me, but it's, I've experienced discrimination and prejudice like all my life. And a middle-aged white man, basically an editor of The Australian equivalent, saying, I've never experienced that, so you're wrong.
Mm. Something I sent through to you, but I was very stupid and forgot to print off and bring, was a piece done by the Ethnic Communities Council of Victoria in 2015. It was a series of roundtables, and there was one that really struck me, which was interviewing Afghani Muslim women, who some of whom wear hijabs and some who don't, some who wear niqabs and a range of headscarves, and some who do not cover up at all. And it was them talking about how they are treated by the general public, people who are not a part of their cultural and religious community. And none of these women, to my knowledge, were bringing cases to the Human Rights Commission under 18C. One lived next door to a group of people who, because she wore a headscarf, would drive their car towards her over the nature strip and stop just before hitting her and her child. They called the police, but because the people told the police, no, 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 they're making it up, and these people didn't have very good grasp of English, they just said, okay, well, there's nothing we can do about it. There were stories about women who do not wear hijabs or niqabs or any kind of head covering at school disclosing that they're Muslim when their kids are playing in a playgroup together, and the other mother saying to her child when they got home, we're not going back, or you can't play with that child anymore. And, you know, these women, these people aren't taking these cases to 18C, partly because they don't realise that they can access them. I mean, you know, your kid not going to, but someone telling their kid they can't be friends with a Muslim, not going to be an 18C case. And any...
Well, sorry, they're really weak protections in the first place. Like, they're not... Yeah. It's, and I saw the Australian was outraged today at the idea that Labor might bring equivalent protections to the disabled and LGBTI people. Because, I mean, imagine a world in which disabled people... It was harder to abuse disabled people or LGBTI people. And the Australian had a front page today worrying about the impact on, you know, honest, upstanding, ordinary Australian citizens who simply want to argue that LGBTI people are perverts who are a threat to children. And they might then get in trouble if there was some kind of law protecting LGBTI people from random abuse. I mean, think of the people who want to describe your community as dangerous to children. Why don't you think of their rights for a change?
I want to know what these people are scared of.
Well, they're scared that you'll raise children to be... to not discriminate against LGBTI people.
Well, you certainly won't raise them to be gay, because, I mean, I'm just going by the statistics, but my parents were straight, my 8 siblings are all straight.
Well, I imagine that their theory is that the more we get to bully LGBTI kids into thinking that being gay is bad, we surely can convince a few of them to be self-hating and to, you know, live the straight lifestyle. Unhappily, sure. Mm. And, you know, unhappily for any partners they end up marrying or anything like that. Sure, it's creating misery all around.
Yeah. And do you know what, they want to go back to that time. I know so many older gay men who had families and had to tear those families apart or commit suicide. Like, that was the option they were faced with. And do they want us to go back to that time where they're bullying kids into going, well, no, I just have to be what my parents expect of me. I just have to be what the world thinks is normal.
Well, let's get on to the marriage equality stuff, because there's the CEO letter this week and some weird stuff back from Dutton and so forth. But before we leave 18C, before we leave Leak, so first of all, we had a public memorial for Leak, at which, did you see all the people who were there? It was everyone from News Limited. It was the Prime Minister. It was all the worst assholes from the Liberal Party. Yeah, it was your Mark Lathams, your John Howards, every far right dickhead you could think of was there. And the Prime Minister standing up there talking about how Bill Leak, his friend Bill Leak, was a uniter.
So
again, this... like opposite. It's like, are these people doing?
So I might have an unpopular opinion. I'm all for all of those people going to Bill Leak's funeral. I'm all for...
Did you see that Doctor Who episode at the start? The first one with Martha, where there's a hospital.
Yeah.
And they're all in a hospital, and then it suddenly gets transported to the moon.
and everyone's in trouble because they need to catch the one person, and everyone will die if they can't catch the one.
Anyway, the point is that hospital that they're all in is transported to the moon. I don't know what my point I'm making about that room in which all of the people who like Bleak were sitting. I'm not sure what analogy I'm drawing there. Sorry, go on.
Anyway, so I have no issue with all of those people attending. I don't have an issue with the Prime Minister speaking at the memorial. Don't
you? Don't?
No, I don't.
The leader of the country declaring that this man is a uniter.
No, let me finish my point. So he can stand there and say he was my friend. I thought he was a great man. I didn't particularly disagree with what he was doing or whatever he wants to say. I take exception to lying about who he was. And I ended up, like, people getting really angry with me on a Facebook post I made because I wrote quite an honest thing that said, Bill Leake harmed my community, harmed communities that I work with, harmed communities that I care about every single day.
Yep.
He did these awful, awful things. And I do not begrudge anyone mourning him. I do not begrudge that there were people who loved him. But I do not want people to remember him as something he was not. He was a divider. He was a person who did things that I thought were bad, and I thought of him as a bad person. And
well, more than that, he did things that specifically demonized the LGBTI community, Aboriginal people. He demonized them. Like, I was called a dirty leftist,
and I was ruining his name, and how dare I speak ill of the dead?
Oh, but they were just being politically correct.
But this is what frustrates me. So I think it's great. You know, Turnbull was friends with him. Get up, speak. That doesn't bother me. What bothers me is that
fairly damning indictment on Turnbull.
Well, no, I'm all for.
I mean, you know, amongst a whole lot of other damning indictments on Turnbull based on everything he does.
No, see, I'm of the mind that, you know. So Bill Leake could have been this intense art installation, essentially, where he put these things out there to see how it went. You never know.
No, that frankly, would not be an excuse. No.
I'm not saying it's an excuse, but I'm saying...
He doesn't get to be like, it was all satire. No, because he caused harm.
But you can be friends with Bill Leake and be the Prime Minister. I don't have an issue with that.
I think if you're the Prime Minister and you're supposed to represent... Like, the whole fiction of representative democracy being that these people... that most of us didn't vote for, somehow represent us. The Prime Minister should not, particularly absurdly, calling him a... Like,
Uniter is my issue with the whole thing.
The Prime Minister should not be... Well, but even if the Prime Minister recognised that the guy was a divider, that's the reason why he shouldn't be there. He shouldn't be there speaking for, boosting the reputation of a dividing person who harmed a lot of his constituents, the people he wants to represent.
I tend to think that I would rather not police something that closely. I police it to the extent that I think he needed to be honest about it and say that Bill Leake was a divisive figure and I may not have agreed with everything he said, but he was my friend. He was there as his friend. And I don't think that we should take those things away. Like, Malcolm Turnbull knew Bill Leake for much longer.
But it's not a private thing where he's just chatting about a mate he's missed. He knows full well that Leake is being used by the Oz in particular as part of a giant culture war now. They're trying... And following that, and in fact, there's all this stuff this week from the News Corp papers about how it was Bill Leake dying that prompted Turnbull to make the move on 18C. So... that stuff that they were doing at that public memorial is not without consequence. And the consequence is that the Libs are now watering down 18C. Now, Turnbull can stand up there and say that he's strengthening it, which anybody who looks at why he's doing it and the people around him and the people supporting it know full well that's a lie. Like, none of the people supporting this change are people who wanted 18C strengthened. Like, just look at what...
Who was the one that was complaining that he couldn't use the N-word?
I don't know, but I mean, I've seen people being like, you know, okay, so the two big examples that they have are Leake, who
frankly
was clearly
harmed communities.
Yeah, and those Queensland University students who, according to the right, were brutally persecuted by the Human Rights Commission, and they incurred huge legal costs, except they didn't because they were given freebie pro bono advice by this far right QC.
And also, did it settle or was it just dismissed or what happened?
I think the complainant ultimately pulled it. It was I mean, the ANC was always weakened by 18D anyways. Like, this whole thing where they're pretending ANC is really powerful is bullshit, because Leake would have got away with it. Although, there's massive exemptions for sort of fair comment. The reason why Andrew Bolt lost is because his articles were riddled with errors and obvious errors.
Yeah.
So he failed on the basis of being not just not just because he was being racist, but because he was incompetent.
Mm.
That, I mean, that's how he lost. So, like, ANC was always weak. And the idea, and it's a bit of a weird thing where we're trying to desperately defend this thing. And, because it is an attack. The reason why they're weakening is to send a message to racist people that they can speak more freely. But ultimately, ANC in and of itself is not all that strong anyway.
No, it's not.
It wasn't before.
But is red herring the right term? I think that if they're putting this out there as something, as a big achievement, they're putting this out there as if it's a big issue. The fact is, this is a fringe issue that they've brought to the front in terms of, like, people who want to get rid of 18C. They are a fringe group. This has been brought to the front. It's a distraction from the fact that what has Turnbull achieved?
No, they weren't bringing it up to boost Turnbull. They brought it up because they were just... I think if there's a certain group of privileged white people who are just so affronted at the idea that there's any kind of mechanism by which they're victims. Why is Turnbull
bringing it forward?
Oh, like, Turnbull's doing it because he's trying to get his backbench on side and he's trying to hose down. This is the same with both of these things. So
it's a distraction. It's getting the backbench on side, but it's something...
Well, Turnbull's not bringing it, though. Turnbull's just trying to get it to go away because they keep coming to him with it. He can't... I don't think Turnbull wants 18C up there at all. I think Turnbull wanted it to piss off. But these idiots have been pushing
it. Does he want up there?
I don't know. He wants to be Prime Minister. Like, he doesn't have anything that he apparently stands for.
He might be more like Trump than we realise.
He just wanted the...
He just wants to be in charge. Oh, my God.
His BMW that was showing up. This sort of super armoured BMW thing he drives around in. That's this...
No, I haven't seen it.
You've got to Google the Prime Minister's BMW and put together by BMW is this special sort of super VIP thing with...
You know, is it something that every Prime Minister gets?
No, it's a newer, because they used to do all the Australian cars. Mm. And they sort of switched to BMWs recently.
Are any cars made in Australia anymore?
I don't think so, no.
No, well, there you go.
But Daniel Andrews keeps on boasting about how his trains, unlike the New South Wales ones, are going to be built in Victoria. Ballarat? Yeah, whereby... You know, a lot of people used to work for Ford and things when we had it. And you know what? That's freaking important because a country needs to have manufacturing capability. It needs to have the skill set that it can make stuff.
Yeah.
And frankly, it's worth subsidizing if we're about to, if it's that or lose it, because it's actually important to have those skills here. Anyway, well, I mean, we do have skills. We make what are they called? The Bushmaster armored vehicle things, which are designed to... If something explodes under them, it sort of diverts it off to the side. And
I've never heard of these. Anyway. I feel like I'm going to have to do a serious deep dive in Google later.
We do make some things. So the other thing that's been throwing up at Turnbull that Turnbull would like to have go away is marriage equality. Because, of course, he's wedged now. He accepted this idiotic idea that it's the plebiscite or nothing. Obviously, he can't get the plebiscite through. Now they're trying for this postal plebiscite idea.
Honestly, the stupidest idea. I saw a tweet and I wish I could attribute it to the person who tweeted it because I thought it was brilliant. Let's have a plebiscite, except it can only be members of parliament and only after the bells have been ringing for 4 minutes. I was like, oh, that's brilliant. Yes. They can call it a plebiscite.
Yes.
Except it'll be binding. But, you know, whatever. That doesn't matter. It's just...
They're all people. Why can't we just poll those people?
Poll them and then whatever they poll...
In fact, this polling process can be called, like, you could have somebody at the front of Parliament saying, I call for a vote, and then all of those people voting.
Oh, it's revolutionary, really.
They should try that kind of plebiscite. It's mad. Because they are determined, they are obsessed with this idea, because the fundamentalist, Lars Shelton wants it.
Well, Lars Shelton didn't want it anyway. Like, when it was defeated, he was like, this is a victory, we didn't actually want it.
But he says everything's a victory, because he's a lying idiot.
Yeah. But the point is, no one wanted it. It was just a delaying tactic. And it was a delaying tactic because they knew that no one wanted it. And
I think so he does just... now. I think the Christians think that... I need to stop calling them Christians because they're not. I think that the anti-marriage fundamentalist bigots, so your marriage alliance, Sophie York and your ACL, Lars Shelton idiots. Not idiots, just, you know, shameless dissemblers. I think that they have convinced themselves that they can... through, if there was a campaign and there was a plebiscite, I reckon they think that they could win it. I reckon they refuse to accept that the majority of Australians are wedded to the idea, as it were, and they think that they could actually,
if it was voluntary, demonizing. I think they could win it. They could win a voluntary vote, because what you're asking people to do in a voluntary vote, and I don't think there should be a plebiscite at all.
Of course not.
But you're asking basic rights. For a majority of people to have an interest in something that doesn't affect them. And you will get my mother voting because she's really, really wants my marriage recognised here and she wants me to have another wedding because she didn't get to go to mine. And so you'll get her. But you won't get someone who lives four doors down from my mum who's like, I couldn't care less.
But you will get all the fundamentalists who go to church every day.
The fundamentalists, on the other hand, will.
They're very organised. They have a meeting every Sunday.
They do. And that's the difference, is that we as quite a small community have to rally people that have no invested interest. And something being voluntary immediately puts us not on the back foot. Like, we're in the back paddock. We're starting 100 metres back.
And there probably are more fundamentalists than there are LGBTI people. And the fundamentalists have been convinced that it isn't irrelevant to them, that it's not a side issue. They're being convinced that if we get marriage equality, they will lose their religious freedom.
Now, just like that religious freedom they lost when we legalised divorce.
Yes.
Or no-fault divorce.
But you'll notice that they're no longer running the argument on the basis of gay people are bad, or gay people can't form stable relationships, or gay people aren't able to commit and have good, loving relationships. They've ceded that ground, and now they're running it on two lines, because they're basically left to find things that people feel squishy about, because they don't know anybody in those circumstances.
Well, so they haven't loved joining it.
Yes, so they're doing Won't You Think of the Children, and they've got the incredibly offensive line where they try and link it to the stolen generation, the idea that you're taking a child's parent away from them.
Like, I know so many gay couples that are raising kids right now who are going through issues when...
But you took the other parent, the biological other parent, away.
Sometimes the other parents are part of that life as well. That's the thing that bothers me. And, you know, sometimes they're not. And, you know, I'm not saying... And I personally, I think a kid needs two loving parents. And don't tell me that lesbians don't have male influences, because I'm a male influence to the child of lesbians. And,
and fundamentally, marriage and children are not the same thing.
They are not.
There are countless marriages that have nothing to do with children, and there are countless children being raised by de factos. LGBTI people are raising children now. Yes. It has nothing to do with marriage at all. It is a false link.
And you almost feel like that, and you know, when Lyle Shelton ends up on Sky News or whatever, and he's arguing this point, the journalist never says, so should we take all the children off gay couples now?
Yeah.
Because if you want to follow this to its logical conclusion, that's the logical conclusion. You're saying that we can't get married because we might raise children, and that's the stolen generation all over again, which is incredibly offensive to Indigenous Australians. The logical conclusion of that is we need to take all of the children off gay couples now, because you're saying that that's a wrong thing. That's happening. That's happening so much. You know, I'm 29 years old. My friends are having babies at the moment, and a lot of gay friends are having babies. So what are we doing about that? If this is such a concern, where's your campaign to steal children from two lesbians down the road from me?
And if the definition in the Marriage Act is the way marriage has to be, that's what marriage is, a union of one man and one woman entered into voluntarily for life. So what you're saying is that you're about to campaign to ban divorce? Because we're not mentioning that definition anymore.
Lyle Shelton, to his credit, once a very long time ago on a radio station that my husband used to host a show on, did say that he was glad the marriage equality debate had brought up the issue of divorce. He did also say that homosexuality was only removed from the DSM manual because of lobbyists.
Right. Was put in there because of bigots in the first place?
Oh, well, that's right.
Like, there was the assumption that it's bad, therefore people are...
But honestly, that is the last time I've heard him use that language. And this is...
I'd like him to do it, because I think it's really important for people to think... You know how they like the idiotic slippery slope? And so the slippery slope is a fallacy. They're like, well, if you have gay marriage, then you'll have to have polygamous marriage. Now, first of all, it's their book that's got polygamy in it. Their Hollywood is not... Secondly, what's morally wrong with polyamory in the first place? The only problem with polyamory is that I haven't seen a model for how you would regulate it, because I don't know how you'd regulate it, because there's some consent issues in, like, adding people and taking people. How do you actually set up a polyamorous marriage setup? Because if people can come out of, like, people staying in some parts of it or not others, as soon as you get more than two people, poly is really hard to put up a model for. I'm happy, because I don't think it's a moral issue. I think it's a practical issue. How do you actually regulate poly marriage? Or there's a whole other question of, should marriages be prioritised ahead of other forms of relationship?
Yes.
Like, why does the law regulate marriages in the first place, really? Because it's nothing to, as I straight-splained to Tom last week. And let's do this, because there, the other thing when I was listening to the Sky News thing is they were talking about, the right wing always call it same-sex marriage, which is an obnoxious term because it ignores trans and intersex people and so
gender non-conforming people and non-binary people.
It's not about same-sex, it's about not having a restriction that you've got to be different.
Two consenting adults.
So same-sex marriage is a dodgy term. Paul Kelly, the former editor of The Australian, who they have floating around ranting about right-wing shit, calls it gay marriage, which also blocks out lesbians, so good for you.
That guy on Q&A last week, or this week, called it homosexual marriage.
Well, that's like calling women females. Yeah. That's the
classic. That's when it's like, oh, you got a bunch of blokes, and then the female team, and you're like, why did we say that?
And where was he from? He was connected to one of the...
Did he run for something? I don't know, I read about him. Everyone was linking to an article from ages ago where he had said awful things about the LGBTI community.
Yeah, well, as you can imagine, if somebody's calling it homosexual marriage. But then somebody pointed out to me, and I said, look, you know, obviously the term that is an accurate description of what we're doing is marriage equality. And somebody's like, well, that's a bit vague. Why is it marriage equality? It doesn't say what kind of marriage it is. Well, how's it equal? I'm like, but that's the whole point. It's equality. It's
equal access to marriage.
Yes. Like, it could not be... Because it's nothing... And this was the thing I was arguing to Tom. And I think marriage equality, Australians for Marriage Equality, who, by the way, as a person who is signed up to both Australians for Marriage Equality and on the other side, the Marriage Alliance and ACL stuff, Australians for Marriage Equality are being... they're being thumped by the amount of volume of stuff coming out from Australians for Marriage Equality... sorry, what's it called? Marriage Alliance and the ACL. Those people have, like, it's an email every day or so. They've got their little digest, like the Corey Bernardi sort of thing, where they have all their links of terrifying things that are happening, of children being, encouraged not to discriminate against trans kids, you know, that kind of horror.
It perplexes me. It perplexes me. We were about to, I want to move on to that next topic, but I feel like,
well, because I was still doing why it's equality. So shortly, how's it going to go? Marriage equality call, they talk about marriage being about love. And that this is what the debate about is, that everybody can love.
Mm.
But frankly, I think there's an argument to be made that there's a real problem with marriage being prioritised at all. And I don't think it's entirely, and because you've got a bunch of conservatives being out there going, well, isn't it great that the gay community is finally approving of marriage and not trying to change it?
Well, it is a conservative institution. And
so we don't need, so it's got nothing to do with whether marriage is good or bad. Isn't the fundamental point, if it's in the law, equality
is in that. That is always my point. And someone's doing that stupid incest and bestiality thing, and my fundamental argument for that is a gay relationship, or a relationship that involves people of the LGBTI spectrum, is that relationship illegal? No. Why is the marriage? Because that's simple. My relationship's not illegal. My relationship's been decriminalized, yet my marriage is illegal. I am married in another country, and that marriage is not recognized here. And therefore, it makes no sense.
Yeah.
Because why is my relationship not illegal, but my marriage is?
Which is why marriage equality is such a totemic and fundamental issue for LGBTI people, whether or not they want to get married. Because it's got nothing to do with whether you want to marry. It's purely to do with... there is a reason why the fundamentalists want to stop LGBTI people marrying. It's because they don't want LGBTI people and their relationships being viewed as equal to straight people.
And that view of equal is actually a really strong message. And, you know, I grew up in a tiny country town, you know, very, very religious family. And that kind of message, that top-down messaging, you might not think it penetrates, but it does. You know, and you go into my old primary school where, you know, kids were not very accepting of gay kids, or anyone really that was different. That primary school, that high school, they are so much more accepting. You know, there are kids at my high school now who are messaging me, because that my nieces and nephews go there, telling me they can't wait for marriage equality and they want to know how they can help. That's a tiny country town. So this positive messaging that's coming from Australian marriage equality, this positive messaging that 70% of people support marriage equality, is cutting into a tiny country town with 3,000 people.
And that's what the ACL are fighting against. They're fighting against the idea of LGBTI relationships being equal. That's what they hate. That it's they don't want the ability of... they don't want people contradicting their message to their own children that if they're LGBTI, there's something wrong with them. They need to stop being LGBTI. Like, they want all of this stuff about parents' rights and this, and how terrible they, you know, and parents need to be able to pull out kids from safe schools. It's because they want parents to have the right and the power to discourage their children who are LGBTI from self-actualizing and being the people that they are. This is all about fundamentalists wanting to control children and resisting anything that will normalize and equalize LGBTI people, which is, of course, why LGBTI people are fighting so hard for it. Because this is what the battleground is. The battleground is, are we going to be supporting LGBTI kids to feel equal or not? The fundamentalists want them to feel, want to be able to bully them, and LGBTI people want them to be supported. And that's why this is there is no way to reconcile this argument. And that's why the backup position and why the Libs are working so hard with their, well, you know, the Lib moderates are like, well, let's get this in now while we can get the religious protections in there. Because what they want, what they mean by the religious protections is, okay, we've lost the broad fight. We can't defend the other children out there, but at least we can protect our own children. At least we can make, you know, bully our own children into thinking that LGBT, being LGBTI is wrong.
And this connects to another fundamental thing, and it's the fundamental tactic of the Australian Christian Lobby and Marriage Alliance is misinformation. And this comes to safe schools. I, you know, I work with a lot of straight white men, and I ask them, oh, what do you think safe schools is? And they say, oh, it's transgender people going into schools and telling kids that they can try being trans.
Like, yeah, that's what they think it is.
And they think that because...
teaching children to bind their breasts and cut off their penises and tuck their penises.
Which has nothing to do with safe schools. Safe schools is a teacher development program. You know when your kids get a day off school because they're having a professional development day?
Mm-hmm.
Teachers are sometimes going to a safe school seminar and learning about a kid in my class identifies as gay. Kid in my class identifies as trans. How do I handle that? How do I start socializing that in the classroom? How do I bring it into my lessons? There's nothing about chest binding.
It was a link. It was for a link if somebody something. Was going to do it, how you can do it safely.
And trans kids, like trans female to male transgender people, will bind their chest. That is a fact. That is something that they will do because they are trying to actualize who they really are. We need to make sure they access information that helps them do that in a safe way and not an unsafe way. And that the ACL would rather kids harm themselves than do something safely. They would rather kids attempt suicide than identify as the gender to which they are.
Well, they do not accept that trans people real. That, like, fundamentally, like, here's Lyle yesterday. Having biological males in girls' toilets, shower facilities at school is not something most women would consider safe. Biological males. He's talking about trans girls.
He is.
He does not. That's right. He refuses to accept that trans girls are girls or trans women are women. And there is no way to debate. Like, he's in. And he's relying heavily on the idea that most people. He can't argue that gay people are terrible and perverted now because he knows that most people now know. Gay people. Gay people are out enough that people now know gay people around them. There are a lot fewer trans people.
Exactly.
And therefore, he can get away with saying trans people are just confused. And he'll do feign sympathy. He'll be like, well, it's very sad that they're confused. And that's why it's really important because children will grow out of it. Children who think they're trans grow out of it with time.
But and it brings us back to misinformation because they talk about. Young children who go to the Royal Children's Hospital Gender Service, they talk about it like they're making irreversible decisions.
Oh, yeah, they pretend that 4-year-olds... If you ask people who believe who read the Herald Sun or whatever, what is happening to trans kids, you know, if you ask them, true or false, 4-year-olds are having their penises cut off, you would get a staggering number of people saying yes. Oh, it's a dumb lie.
It breaks my mind. Anyway, the thing is that Lyle Shelton's kids could be in their primary school and high school using the toilet with a trans kid and not know.
Yeah, how often does Lyle, like when he's at the toilet, go and check everybody else's genitals?
Well, precisely. And if they're a trans kid, they're not going to be using... You know, if they're a trans male, they are not going to be using a urinal. They'll go to a cubicle. No one knows.
If they're a trans girl, they will almost certainly be going to a... Well, of course they'll be going to a cubicle.
There's no other option. But the thing is that... And, you know, there is a whole spectrum of transgender, and not everyone goes on hormones, and not everyone you know, there's this expectation that everyone goes through the same journey and they don't. Mm. And that is the first frustrating thing. But if a kid at a primary school or high school has gone on puberty blockers, is maybe on cross-sex hormones, you don't know that they're trans, you will never know that they're trans unless they tell you.
Mm.
That's a part of this process. It's a part of going on those puberty blockers and having time to make decisions and then going on those cross-sex hormones to start that transition process, all of which...
But what if you're a fundamentalist person and you've raised... You had a child and you're sure they were a boy and then they turn out to be a girl. Like, that must be really confusing and like, it would be mildly inconvenient for you having to readjust your expectations that you've gendered them very heavily from birth. Like, why aren't you willing to consider the inconvenience to parents who would really like their child to be a certain gender?
Look...
Think of their suffering.
I think of my mother who... you know, did not support me being gay, but ultimately came around and is now a huge advocate and supporter because she could recognize that I went from being incredibly unhappy to incredibly happy.
Mm.
And I challenge any parent who watches their child go from being incredibly unhappy, like suicidally unhappy, to being incredibly happy and growing into someone who loves who they are and expresses themselves in a way that they've never seen before, and challenge them to say, this is wrong. And lots of parents do it because they cut themselves off before they get to see that happiness. And the joy of allowing trans kids a safe space to talk about what they're going through and work out if they are trans. And, you know, that's something, you know, some kids it's really easy, some kids it's not so easy. But giving them that space and letting them work that out is resulting in more healthy, happy kids. And my argument is that the ACL doesn't want healthy, happy kids because they are doing everything they can to take kids that have a pathway to being happy and healthy and stop it.
Mm-hmm. And I don't know how much of it is even religious, because it's not like there's any great... Well, I suppose they'll say in the Bible, God created them male and female or something. Like, there probably is a religious aspect to it, but I don't really think it's any more religious than the fact that they're obsessed with homosexuality, which is, it's icky for them.
Mm.
They think, like, they don't like the idea that they might get turned on by someone who looks like a girl and then find they have a penis. Like, they don't want to think about gay men having sex and anal sex or something. Well, like,
on that,
so much of this is just down to the squick factor.
They must think about gay sex so much more than I do. Seriously, like... I can't turn on the news each week without seeing someone from the ACL or the Marriage Alliance talking about gay people and what they do. And as a gay person...
They have so many partners. They don't believe in marriage.
Oh, my God.
The people who... Well, I imagine that poly-gay people aren't really keen on getting married. So they're not... But again, you know, to everybody in the gay community who doesn't give a shit about marriage equality, it's not about freaking marriage.
But do you know what I think?
It's about being treated equally for the law.
Their big fear...
Well, the ACL or gay commitment... I think there's also gay commitment phobes who, like, have boyfriends who might get a bit pushy if the marriage...
No, I think
they're the real sufferers, victims of marriage equality.
But marriage equality, and I freely admit this, is a huge drain on the focus of the LGBTI community. And absolutely to the detriment of other issues, which are massive. You know, the trans community is facing a lot of discrimination, is facing a lot of barriers... And, you know, I am someone who puts a lot of work into marriage equality because that's important to me. I put a moderate amount of work into trans rights, not as much as I should. Imagine once marriage equality is sorted and this massive, you know, relatively massive community is able to now hone its focus on dealing with issues that
are confronting trans people. Yeah, that's why the Christians aren't going to cede an inch of ground. They're going to fight as far as...
Because the next step is us... ensuring that trans kids
are Christians, the fundamentalists, like that's all.
And you know, I try to walk and chew gum at the same time. I try to advocate marriage equality and advocate trans.
But I would
rights.
Say, like, it's not marriage equality is not a trivial side issue because
no,
marriage,
it's not.
It's because it isn't marriage. We call it marriage equality, but all what the fight is LGBTI people being treated equally by the law. And frankly,
and that will
if the law
a
was
a ripple effect throughout whole country.
If the law that we were fighting against was, you know, access to school. Oh no, that's even more fundamental. But if it was, I don't know, some kind of tax benefit, or if it was a I've got a mental block, whatever else it is that the federal government regulates. Like, if there was some other area that was specifically refusing to recognize LGBTI people, and I liked how quick, of course, they were really quick to recognize LGBTI people for Centrelink, where it was to their detriment.
Well, yeah, they made all the, what is it, 54 changes, 59 changes?
Yeah, the ones to the detriment.
They made sure that if I was in a same-sex relationship, I couldn't claim Centrelink, which I am absolutely happy to be held to the same standard as, you know, there are problems,
yeah, no, the pro- there the problem are problems there with
Centrelink,
that,
but I'm happy to be held to the same standard as a heterosexual couple. My issue is that I'm held to the same standard without getting the one right I was asking for.
Yes, it's kind of full equality or not, but that's right. But it doesn't matter that it's about marriage. It could be, you know, it could be the right to get punched in the face by Christopher Pine every week. And frankly, everybody's entitled to the
equal
right.
Can we
reverse
that?
Oh, okay. Peter Dutton. So we had the CEOs of various companies coming out, and I love how angry the Libs are about this. So the Libs are, and this is, I'm channeling this through Peter Credlin's remarks, but I think she's right that this is their attitude. The Libs are so angry that although the Business Council of Australia and although the industry, what was the Australian Industry Group, whatever they are, that the lobby groups, the business advocate lobby groups will you know, make comments about wanting lower corporate taxes and various things. But the actual companies themselves don't come out and support the government in tax cuts funded by kicking the poor in the face. And obviously the reason they don't do that is because it would be a massive PR blunder because many of their customers would be like, fuck you, I'll shop somewhere else. Like, the more actual companies, like the companies are happy to get their lobbyists to do it, they're happy to give lots of money to the Liberals to do it for them, but they don't come out and publicly support the government when it's, you know, cut to doing tax cuts for big companies to kick the poor in the face, but funded by kicking the poor in the face. And the Libs are really resentful about the big companies not coming out and supporting them on that. And then when big companies come out and they support marriage equality, and the big companies were saying, on the basis, this letter that the CEO signed, they were saying it's on the basis that it is an economic benefit to our customers. Like, this is a distraction. Mm. And it's
do you know how you get CEOs on board with something?
Mm-hmm.
It's an economic benefit to them.
Yes.
So,
but so are tax cuts. But the thing about marriage equality or sometimes climate change and stuff is that they can do that without pissing off a majority of their customers.
Absolutely.
Whereas defending corporate tax cuts would piss everyone off. So they don't want to do it because they're not out there to be burned for a political end. That's what their attitude will be. That's what the freaking Libs are for. That's why we give you money.
So Peter Dutton thought it was a really good idea to tell Alan Joyce to go back to his knitting.
Yeah. Now, this is fantastic because, like, I had, on the Sky News thing, they're asking Greg Hunt about these remarks of Peter Dutton about the knitting and saying, look, you know, weren't they homophobic? And Dutton, and Hunt's of course saying, no, of course they weren't. It's just making the point that it's important for everybody to have a say. Like, but he, like, ducking it. I want to know what the non-homophobic explanation is for the knitting reference.
I'm in two minds of it. I get back to your knitting as go back to what you're good at.
Is it?
But
when did Dutton last say go back to
knitting? No, I think there was some kind of intent behind it.
Who says go back to your knitting? Like, when did you last hear that expression?
Oh, my mum uses it.
That's because your mum is a
knitter. No, but, like, I recognise it as go back to what you're good at, except I think there was a homophobic intent behind it. He was saying it to a man because a man shouldn't knit.
Because it's a it's supposed to be feminised, and he's saying, that's right, it was a sledge. It was a homophobic sledge. Like, there's no alternative. Check out my baby blank, my baby hat in, like,
Jeremy
turns out to be
knitting.
pride colours. I'm out to the bit where I sort of start reducing it at the top.
But
check out that reading; it's very neat.
if we think of knitting as, if we think back to knitting as go back to what you're good at, go back to what your business
which
is.
Which it isn't.
But if we think of that, this is Alan Joyce's business. This is every CEO's business, is that marriage equality is good for the economy. It's good for their employees. It's good for their stakeholders. It's good for their shareholders. Qantas employs a lot of LGBTI people. I used to work in the airline industry a very long time ago.
Well, look, I've seen the offensive stereotypes on, like, the old fast forward or whatever it was of the stewardess.
They are offensive, but I'm going to be honest, there's a little bit of accuracy. Like, in the sense that it is a profession where a lot of gay men go.
Right.
I have a lot of friends still who are stewards, who work in the airline industry,
yeah.
Or work on the checking desk, or work in the call centre, and
Well, it's like the SDA being the biggest union fighters against equality when so many of their young workforce will be LGBTI people.
Mm. And young people who support LGBTI people. But the point is that this is in the interest of those CEOs for their employees, for their stakeholders, for the people who buy their product.
Mm.
That is their knitting. So...
And I like the libs don't have any problem with CEOs going out there and saying stuff they agree with. Like, they were perfectly happy. The same, Dutton was perfectly happy with Cooper's going out there and saying, look, why can't we just talk in a general, light-hearted, friendly fashion about you guys being discriminated against under the law?
And I really want to talk about that, except if I'm doing a stuck in my career, I really want to save.
Well, we also talked about it last week with Tom. One last thing before we get on to Australia vs. Humanity, and this on the same subject, is back on what we're talking about, I suppose, with the situation for trans kids in Victorian schools. Apparently, the forms now for the VCE and the VCAL pupils next year, although, as the Herald Sun puts it, some as young as 15... are going to be able to choose whether they are male, female, or gender X. So that's from the Victorian Curriculum and Assessment Authority. So the Herald Sun ran a respectful headline, Class Gender Bender, and they quoted the ACL's Victorian director, the hateful Dan Flynn, who said, it was a threat to change rooms and bathroom usage. I assume that all these fundamentalists have, like, two bathrooms in their house, like, gender specified, like they've got a male bathroom and a female bathroom.
Well, I also think they have no idea what it's actually like on the ground.
No, they're mad. And could create problems in selecting sex-specific sports teams. Have you heard this one, the idea that if trans women are out there, they will be able, because they have... Okay, first of all, we assume that they've all gone through the puberty blockers and the hormone treatments. But simultaneously, we assume that they haven't transitioned and that they've got biologically... They've got bodies that will give them advantage against
talk
women.
About these broad things, and at the local level where this is actually being dealt with, this isn't an issue. I think the gender X thing is problematic because, as you will see later in the article, there's a quote from Sally Goldner, who's the executive director of Transgender Victoria, which says that's not what we need. We need male, female, other, please specify, and prefer not to say.
Yeah, gender X is a bit, it's like a hack version of getting it wrong. But this is in the center of this thing on the third page of the bloody Herald Sun. They give this person several paragraphs to say this hateful shit. Giving boys the right to self-identify as a girl creates all those safety problems. Boys are boys and girls are girls, and there would be a fractional category of people who are truly intersex. We are also opening the door to say, I don't want to be a male or a female, I want to be somewhere else. This is out of step with the school community's expectation and parents' expectations.
So, this is the JCL on misinformation all over again. Firstly, you don't just self-identify. There is an incredibly complicated process that a young person has to go through in order to be identified as transgender. You have to attend... in Victoria, the Royal Children's Hospital Gender Unit. You would get a referral there. You go through, you meet a psychologist, you meet specialist doctors, you talk about what this means. People assess whether or not you have gender dysphoria, which is what people are diagnosed with. And a lot of transgender people don't like the term diagnosed because they don't feel...
Assumes they have a problem.
Yes.
Assumes they've got an illness.
Precisely. So, firstly, no one's just going, I was a boy yesterday and I'm a girl today. It's so complicated that this guy trivializes it to someone deciding that one day, halfway through a sports lesson, oh, I'm a girl now and I'm going to go play with the girls. That is not what happens.
Well, how obnoxious is boys are boys and girls are girls. They are flat. How do you debate with people who are denying that trans people even exist?
Well,
he refuses. Their line is, they're not real. They're just confused people.
It is mind-boggling. And then, but it also comes down to, at the actual high schools, schools are dealing with this all the time at a local level, and these aren't problems. Things like sporting groups, that's managed on a case-by-case basis. Schools, you know, if someone is transitioning, they make an assessment of where they are in their transition with the help of that child's parents, the child's doctor, and they make a decision of when that move from the boys' team to the girls' team. And it often comes with the move from identifying as a boy to identifying as a girl, or identifying as a girl to identifying as a boy. And they work that out. They make a decision.
there is very little fuss about these decisions, except for this guy who knows nothing about the situation, who's making gross generalizations, doesn't understand what's going on, and is... I think the most galling part of this article is he gets, like, four or five paragraphs, and then Sally Goldner gets, like, three lines.
Yeah.
And, you know, you're taking someone who knows nothing about being transgender, has no understanding of it, is making gross generalizations and coming from a place of not wanting to understand, and you take someone whose job it is to advocate for the rights of transgender people in Victoria, and you treat one person's opinion as equal to the others. They are not equal opinions.
They less. Like
she gets less.
So you get Dan Flynn gets basically three lines or two lines three columns, but two lines effectively, two columns effectively. Then you get the opposition education spokesman, Nick Wakeling. So everybody remember the name of Nick Wakeling, hateful idiot, who said Premier Daniel Andrews needs to stop pushing his radical gender and sexuality theories onto other people's children. Yes, Dan Andrews invented the idea of trans people.
But also, what other people's children?
Well, like, as in other people, the parents of trans kids,
I guess.
He's enforcing. He's basically giving the children.
Is it their peers? Like, because like most of those kids don't care or don't know. And oh my god.
Well, that you say that a lot about. You see that a lot about trans kids. You see a lot about poly people. Actually, there's a lot of discrimination now about poly people with people who think that children being exposed to poly people is somehow going to damage their ability, view about how relationships form, and like, although I have to say, if you're worried that your children being exposed to a poly couple is going to encourage them to, or not couple, but a poly grouping, is going to warp their idea of relationships, because, and you think that's bad because poly relationships aren't going to work, well, surely you should like expose your children to the poly people, like let them see these terrible relationships collapse. Like, it'd be an excellent object lesson if your theory about poly is right.
Again, people make generalizations and assumptions of things they don't understand.
I think this is profoundly damaging and hateful from the Herald Sun to be putting up there for people who don't know any trans people, basically just reinforcing bigotry really hard. Like,
but also the making it sound like there's an issue that doesn't exist.
Yeah.
Like, the fundamentals of that article are that there is a real issue on the ground in schools with trans kids using the bathrooms to which they identify.
Mm.
That doesn't exist. That's not happening. I'm sure there are isolated instances of a family finding out that someone's trans and getting upset and saying something to the school, and I absolutely believe that is happening. But I do not believe that there is some endemic issue where school administrators are being weighed down by constant complaints about trans kids, because in most cases, you either don't know or don't care. And kids, when they find out that, when a 6-year-old finds out that someone identifies as transgender and they are now a girl or now a boy,
Kids will accept it.
There's so much I've seen so many kids just go, okay, that's cool, whatever. I want to go play this thing now.
Yes.
That.
I love the joke of the kid who comes down back to visit his parents after, you know, after leaving home and coming back, and he's like, "Mum, Dad, I'm gay," and the mother turning to the father and being like, "No, not." And the father, like, just struggling, like, you can see him. He's just, like, trying to hold his tongue. He's, like, he's trying not to... And then I was like, "Don't you dare!" And he's like, "Hi, gay, I'm Dad!" Yes. They don't really... I'm not sure actually how that fit my point. But I just wanted to say it. But, yeah, exactly. I just don't think it's a big deal. I think there's so many people... Well, in fact, it's at the moment where... Isn't that I'm not even sure what... Is it for marriage equality, that ad that's floating around...
Like, I'm good enough to save your life as a lifesaver. No.
There's that one, but there's also the one where they've got the son there who's like, "I don't like tomato sauce" or something.
They're all having barbecue sauce, and he says, "I like tomato sauce." And
the dad's like, "Fine!" And just like storms off. And then he comes back, he's like, "Oh!"
It's really quite sweet. And he has a boyfriend in the end, it's sweet.
Yes.
That was a good... Look, again, it is these people who have no one... Well, I assume they know that they're peddling misinformation, but...
I don't think they know any trans people. Like, the only trans person that Dan Flynn or Lyle Shelton or Sophie York will have ever met is they will have found somebody who transitioned and regretted it.
Mm. And do you know what? That can happen. No one's sitting here saying that every process is perfect and we've resolved everything. But
there's undoubtedly trans people who lived in the wrong gender for all their lives who also regretted it. So
yeah,
what does that prove?
Exactly. But it's also this thing of going, we need to fix the system so that trans people have time and puberty blockers so that they can make these decisions and take that time and understand exactly who they are. And that's, for some people, that's a really easy thing to do. And for some people, it's really hard.
Maybe it boils down to fundamentally a disagreement on the idea, not just the fundamentals having a squick factor thing about people being
But it all comes back to penises and vaginas.
But maybe it's also about control. Maybe it's also about who's making the decisions about a person, because they like the idea that there's a God. He's told you, he has told you who you are. And the idea of people saying, actually, no, I think I'm this. People being self-actualized and making their own choices about who they are, that feels to them like a slight against their God. Their God made a decision. He gave you a penis. That should be it.
But it,
maybe it's a philosophical difference between, you know, what you doing, do what you're told. Be who you're told you are.
By that same argument, it's like, well, God gave you... I know, they always argue God gave you free will, but, you know...
God gave them the capacity for compassion, you would think, so maybe they should try
using it. I think God made them trans. Like, you know, I don't believe in God, in full disclosure, but if you do, why would God create trans people if they weren't meant to exist?
You go down, look, okay, if we're going to go down the apologetics, we've got the whole... If God's real and God gave you the ability to reason... Like, gave you the ability to reason. Like, okay, human beings, you can reason. This is a thing that I, God, have created you with the ability to reason. Except in this one issue about whether I exist or not, you must not use reason. I will give you no evidence. You have to just take it on faith. If God's real, and that's the theory that's the position God's taken, I give you the power to reason, but you may not use it on the fundamental question of whether you're going to burn in fire for all eternity. If that God would be a dickhead. That is not a nice God. I don't understand how you get past that. But anyway, yes.
Yeah.
Same with... So, okay, let's get on to Australia versus Humanity, because... Okay. Look, we'll end on something positive, but let's do... So, Australia versus Humanity. So, obviously, in a week that we're dealing with Bill Leakin, obviously, the commission is continuing in the Northern Territory, and we talked about that a bit last week. But the other thing that happened in relation to the Dondale Detention Centre, where Aboriginal children were being abused by... Not their parents, Bill. Not abusive, incompetent fathers, Bill. By white governments... and their agents in the prison system, four teenagers were awarded damages this week for their treatment while in detention. No, the court didn't accept that they were tear gassed, but they did accept that they had been humiliated when they were placed in spit hoods, shackled and handcuffed behind their backs as they were led through the adult jail. Essentially, they were awarded $53,000 to the four of them. Basically, they were treated very badly. They didn't accept all of the evidence, but that is a pretty dodgy way to treat people that we are holding in custody.
With Dondale, I think something that's been really forgotten in this whole debate has been that when someone goes into the prison system, the government takes on...
Responsibility.
It takes on the responsibility to treat... that person in a way to ensure their safety, to ensure their health, to ensure that they are treated well. And Dondale is a failure of that. These people were not treated well. They were not kept safe. They were psychologically harmed. They were physically harmed. They were humiliated, and I look at this and I kind of say, is $53,000 a slap on the wrist?
It is a little bit. They didn't even have safety evacuation plans for if there was a fire. With fire plans, management would say, oh, there's an alarm going, don't move, it's all good. But there were no evacuation procedures, no drills. They didn't even have a system for... Because the detainees are locked in their cells, then keeping in mind that these detainees were children, was there a plan for who would manage the keys in the event the children need to be evacuated? So the youth justice officer they were speaking with, his evidence was, the emphasis was on a senior being responsible, but there was nothing formally written. And if I was a new person, how would I actually know what to do, like where a muster place would be? They had a wooden roof that was then put in place in the maximum security unit, and a fire was put out there by a guard out of sheer luck. It was really dangerous. So, but because none of these people can vote, none of these people have any, like, but this is the thing. Like, after this was revealed, you saw why this stuff is happening, because you saw all of the right-wing media trying to blame the children. So the whole line was, these are shit kids. And then, if you're worried about saying they're shit kids, it's not really their fault, because they've got shit parents. But it's all about the victims. And no, like, they're trying to reduce sympathy. And this is the way, and you can do that when people are in prison. You can really, if you're out there saying, you talk about how what terrible thing they did to get in prison. You talk about how badly behaved they are in prison. And then you can have abuse happen and people not care about it, and there not be a general pressure on government to do something about it.
It really...
People joke about prison rape. They're like, ah, you'll get raped in prison. What?
It's terrifying. Like the... Oh, anyway. Dondale has been a really challenging... It's something that I found really hard to engage as a news consumer.
Well, because it's not covered a lot.
It's not covered a lot, but also the stuff you see tends to be quite raw and put out in ways that aren't the general news. So they, you know, which is good that they don't have a filter, but also it's really hard to watch, and it's just really tough to engage on this stuff. And I kind of feel a responsibility to be uncomfortable and see what happened to these people so I can understand it and I can talk about it. Because I just fear that we're just going to repeat it over and over again. It feels like this hasn't taught us anything.
I find it really hard, in fact, to do Australia vs. Humanity at all at the moment, because it feels like we're not getting the stories anymore. It's almost like the news media who used to cover it are almost giving up. And that's part of the reason why people may have noticed that there's not a huge amount of Australia vs. Humanity in the podcast anymore. And it is, that's why. I'm seeing less of it, and it's harder to find. And I think that's why we need to keep doing it. But it's obviously, you know, maybe I should say to people, look, if you see something that's been happening that you think should be in Australia versus Humanity, tweet it at Well May We Say, and like point it out to us, because we're missing things that I think we should all be covering, because and not letting through to the keeper. And it feels like that is now increasingly happening, and we've reached a point. Well, I mean, we're still in a place where Tom Ballard, who we'll talk with in a minute, with Striking My Craw. But he had Kate Ellis on his program, his podcast, Like I'm a 6-Year-Old, a couple of weeks ago. And that was before she resigned. But she was talking, they were talking about the refugee situation. And she was making comments about how it was a difficult issue because you can't, if the America deal falls through, you still got to send them somewhere else, because you can't let them come here, because if you have a commitment that Australian government has made that they will never come to Australia, and then you change your mind about it and you let them come, which, you know, ignores the fact that most of the people came after John Howard said, we'll stop, you know, we won't let them, none of them will come here. Like most of the people, in fact, all of the people that Howard ended up shoving on those islands ended up coming here. But the Libs pretend that didn't happen. But Ellis said, and this is why I want to raise this with you, Damien, as a thing to just, maybe we just see if we can kill this stupid line now. But that she was saying that it's important to deny the people smugglers a product. And Tom did come back at the end and do a bit of a follow-up where he's like, hang on a second. If the problem is that letting them come here encourages people to get on boats and you're worried about them drowning at sea, why would letting them go to America not have the same effect? Basically, why would not letting them go anywhere that is not worse than the place that they're fleeing from? If you're worried about deterrence, that's... anything short of being as bad as the place they're fleeing from won't work. So, America is as much a any other country that's not shit is as much a people smuggler product as Australia.
So I think the government's running two lines, and I think the lines contradict each other. So they have this very powerful and effective border force, which is stopping people from stopping boats from getting here, and they never tell us what's going on there because on water matters. And I think we should all be looking at why aren't they commenting? That's a really important thing that we should always be talking about. Why are they keeping something secret?
Yeah, the idea that, they tell us to stop the boats, but also if we ask them what's happening to the boats, they won't tell us. Oh, well, they must have stopped them. Mm. What?
It's insane. So while they're simultaneously stopping these boats from reaching here with border force, they are also running this line that they need to not give the people smugglers a product to sell by settling these people in Australia. I would argue, and I don't agree with the stopping the boats policy, but you, by having this very effective border force, you can bring those people to Australia and this mythical product that I don't think they've stopped. I think the people smugglers still have a product to sell. They can say Australia's just not talking about it anymore, but people are getting through. There's a product to sell. You know, they act as if putting people on Nauru stops people smugglers from lying to people. These aren't honest people. The people smugglers, they're not saying to people, you know, these are the people who tell people to throw their passports away because, oh, if you have your passport, they'll send you back to your country. No, not having your passport makes your process much harder, but the people smugglers told people to do that because they didn't really care. They just wanted people to get on their boats, spend their money, and try and make a trip to Australia. Whether they made it or make it or not is not a part of their business model.
You know how to destroy the people smugglers' business model?
Fund getting people here on planes?
Yep. Let people get on a plane. You don't need to fund them.
No, just let them get on planes.
It's cheaper than a boat. This whole line that these are rich asylum seekers because they spend the money to be on boats. Well, it'd be cheaper for them to get on a plane. They wouldn't drown. And also, it'd be easier to find them if you don't have to go out to sea because they're at an airport. Give them a visa to come by air.
But there is an element in our asylum, in our humanitarian visa policy, where people who are highly educated sometimes do get overlooked for people who are considered more vulnerable. And, you know, in some cases, rightly considered more vulnerable. But
hang on. Again, you're saying, yeah. This is the other, I mean, we've thrashed that many times, but you're doing the whole line of, it's a play that it's one or the other.
No, and that's right. It shouldn't be one or the other.
No, they didn't used to be linked. Howard linked. So the point I'm making is, what Howard did is he had a certain number of humanitarian places that were on the program, and in the old days, if somebody arrived by boat or unexpectedly, then okay, that was an extra person the government had to deal with. What Howard did is said, "Well, we'll link those two. So if anybody arrives on a boat, we'll take one place away from the other one," and that gave them the ability to run a line of. That gave them the ability to play off refugees against each other.
Mm.
So, this is a good refugee, that's a bad refugee, and the bad refugee took a place from the good refugee. Well, no, they didn't. They arrived, and then the government, in order to... It's like collective punishment. In order to punish the refugee who came, or the world for letting this refugee come, or lefties for letting... Not minding that the refugee came, we punish another refugee. But you don't have to do that. There's an easy solution to that is don't link the two.
Mm.
If somebody arrives in an unexpected way, then okay... Treat them as a separate intake. You have to punish this other person who you say is a genuine refugee. You say this is a good refugee, one that who's gone through the right channels. Why are you punishing them because somebody comes on a boat?
Well, I think the fundamental of it is, like, if we're going to try and... I'm not trying to defend their policy, but if Border Force is as good as they say it is, they can bring those people on Manus and Nauru here and nothing will change.
Yes, so,
which makes me think that there's a lot they're not telling us if they don't think they can bring those people here. So I think it is political because they've told the Australian public they can't bring them here and they're trying to keep this lie up.
Yeah.
I think that potentially... It's entirely political. I'm almost sure that boats are still leaving places and trying to come here.
Yeah, and we just drag them back. See.
We turn them away, we drag them back. So they can drown somewhere that we can't see, and then we can all feel okay about ourselves or something.
Yes, because the dangerous part of the journey to Australia is the part to Australia. When the Australian Border Force drags you back out to sea, that's the totally safe bit of the trip.
But I don't understand if they want to keep peddling that lie that Border Force is stopping the boats and that boats aren't coming anymore. I just think, as a government, you can somehow get away with bringing those people off those hellholes and bringing them to Australia, processing them, letting them contribute to our society, because they will. Refugees are known to be more innovative and to contribute more to the economy than they drain. I don't understand why you wouldn't bring those people here and just say Border Force is strong enough to handle this. I don't think Border Force is strong enough. I don't think that there's any truth in that policy, but they're running these policies that just don't make sense.
The pictures of all the ships is designed to make it look like we can stop them, but it's... I don't believe that they can either, but I think it's almost... I think it's more fundamental than that, and I think it's because the fundamental thing is that deterrence is a bad idea. You cannot do deterrence because the only way to do deterrence is to be worse than the place somebody is fleeing from, and since, unless we are total monsters, we can't do that and shouldn't do that, deterrence will never work. So we try to do this doublethink thing where we convince ourselves that we can be bad enough that it's unpleasant, but not so bad that we actually have to think of ourselves as monsters. So this way you get this simultaneous thing where it's like you get A Current Affair and the Australian pretending that things are actually quite luxurious for the refugees, but simultaneously running the line that, you know, it's unpleasant because it's strong enough to deter them. Like, it's either pleasant, in which case it's either adequate and decent, in which case it's better than the place they were fleeing from, so they will flee to it, or it's worse. Like, it can't be both. It can't be both better and worse. Like,
but do you think the government's also running on this thing where, I mean, for any of this to work, the people smugglers have to be honest people?
No, but I mean,
Have a scam artist at the other end saying, that's all lies. Like, get on here.
Them
and
being resettled, no, it does make sense, because them being resettled means that they will be free people and they'll be able to communicate with their families and say, I got here. So part of, I do understand that there is a difference when they arrive safely and they've got it, they can now start rebuilding their lives. And the fact is, in some ways, what we're doing on Nauru is actually worse than the place they're fleeing from, because we are putting people in this sort of hideous limbo where they have no hope. It's not going to stop people fleeing imminent danger, because it's still, being in limbo is still better than being in imminent danger. But we are breaking and destroying people, and they're like, well, if we treated people with kindness, then they would try to come here. But the problem is that that means that we have to hold them in limbo forever, because they're in limbo forever, or they go somewhere. And if they go somewhere, then whatever place they end up in, where they get to rebuild their lives, is going to be make that process worth it. And so people will still come. Like, there's no way to deter people from coming unless you are prepared to be worse than the places they're fleeing from. And you shouldn't do that. And therefore, deterrence is a terrible idea and will never work. I think
deterrence is a terrible idea.
It can't work. Like, it's logically flawed.
I also believe that you were relying on people who are scam artists to not scam people.
No, I assume they're going to... The whole deterrence also relies on that.
I don't think how deterrence bad it
relies
gets.
On the scam artists and people doing that, not the people smugglers not being honest with them. Because if the people smugglers were honest with them, they'd be pointing out that the boats are dangerous or something. But like, we make the boats more dangerous. We're the ones who turn around and we say, you can't bring people, you can't be a Schindler doing it safely, because we're going to take your boat and destroy it, and we're going to prosecute you. So we basically say the only people who are going to do it are the people who don't mind their boats being destroyed and are happy for the disposable crew to be imprisoned by Australia. We basically make the people smuggler boats worse than they would have been. Like, I mean, it's an obvious market.
I just don't think there's any market in deterrence at all. I don't think it could get bad enough that there still wouldn't be messaging going back to people to flee that would get them on those boats.
And that's
no matter what you did, people will still get on boats.
Yes. No. If you shot people out of the sea, I imagine they would stop, because that message would get back pretty quickly. But I'm suggesting that is the only way you can deter, and it's monstrous, and you would be war criminals, and you should be up before the Hague and thrown out. You should be imprisoned. If you're a government who's prepared to do that to people, you should be imprisoned. But that's why deterrence can't work. Because, like, we've got this half-assed thing where we're just trying to break people and punish them out of spite. But it's not going to work in the way that they think they're trying to get us to work. And nobody believes that it will work. Like,
If they believed it would work, we'd have a better system in place. Like, we'd have another process of getting people here that was safe. Like,
how is this atrocity still happening?
Yeah.
And how is it going to end? And
all on this fallacy that it's for their safety. Like, if it was for their safety, let them come on planes. But
it's not. It's about we don't want, that's why they talk about terrorism, because they're trying to say the people coming are Muslims and Muslims are terrorists is the line. Like, they're pandering to racist memes and stereotypes that they can't expressly say, because that is showing their hand. So they just sort of point at it, allude to it. They know the that's what the dog whistle is. They know that their people are listening. You know, they've got... anyway.
But just, I digress.
Labour Party, fuck off on your whole people smugglers thing. Stop pandering to the right by pushing these lines for them and call bullshit on them. They're not true. And the only reason... I mean, the Labour Party knows they're not true. The only reason they're running them is because they genuinely don't think that you can win an argument on the subject, because they know that deep down people don't want the argument won, because the bottom line is that the people who support the policy are racist and xenophobic. They have been convinced that foreigners are dangerous. They want fewer of them coming, and they've been convinced...
See, I disagree with that. So
there is no way to support this policy without being racist, and I defy anybody to do it for more than 45 seconds without saying something racist.
No, so I'm not defending the policy, but... When Australians are surveyed on this, and so the Scanlon Foundation research surveys Australians on this topic, they generally believe that the humanitarian intake is about right or too low, so it could be higher. But they, when you bring the discussion of asylum seekers coming on boats, they go negative, and that's to do with the rhetoric.
Yeah, it's to do with extensive.
But Australians want more, like. In general, Australians want more people coming on humanitarian visas, and Australians are very supportive of migration. They think multiculturalism is a good thing. It's at like 86% or 85%. But the issue is that the rhetoric around boat arrivals has turned negative. People don't understand migration in Australia. Like, humanitarian entrance and asylum seekers, the smallest, infinitesimal number of people arriving in this country every year. There are hundreds of thousands of people who arrive on... There's like 254 kinds of visas you can come here on. And so much is taken up by this small group that could be bigger, that we'd be happy if it was bigger, because we won't let them come on planes.
I think if you did... I think that... But that's right. But why aren't we letting them come on planes then if people aren't racist? What is it about these people...
But I don't think people recognise that planes are an option.
I think you could be standing out there and shouting at them, and they'll be like, no, we need to have limits because we'll be swapped.
Yeah, if they realise how many people are arriving in this country on all the various visas, it's something in the realm of 250,000 a year.
I'm fairly confident that the bottom line... The thing that makes sense is that people know that this is... that this policy doesn't make any sense. You can't... If you tried to have the argument discussion with them that we just had tonight about somebody who supports the policy, before a minute or two, A, they would have said something racist, and B, then they would have said, shut up, I don't want to talk about it. Because you're asking them to confront a double think that they don't want to confront. They are trying to convince themselves of things that they know are bullshit, but they want to be able to stop... They probably believe the Trump line about rapists and murderers, and you know, they've bought a racist line, and I don't think that. I think part of the Liberal strategy of hiding everything is not only so that they can spread the stupid lie they've stopped the boats. Well, yeah, it's so they can pretend they've stopped the boats, but it's also because I think the reason why they don't want to sing the people in Nauru is that. It would humanise them. They don't want us thinking of them as human beings who are like, oh yeah, why can't we just let them come here? What is the problem with them just coming here?
I just don't have an answer. Like, I feel like...
All right, can I give you some positive news?
Yes, thank God.
Let's read something positive from The Guardian. Record-breaking climate change pushes world into uncharted territory.
Why are you lying to me?
Earth is a planet in upheaval, say scientists, as the World Meteorological Organization publishes analysis of recent heat highs and ice lows.
That's not good news at all.
The record-breaking heat that made 2016 the hottest year ever recorded has continued into 2017, pushing the world into truly uncharted territory, according to the World Meteorological Organization. The WMO's assessment of the climate in 2016, published on Tuesday, reports unprecedented heat across the globe, exceptionally low ice at both poles, and surging sea level rise.
So, I mean, climate change is just in Australia against Australia.
This is the classic thing. Like, I love that Australia, like, the big line that we had when we turned on any action on climate change was, well, we're a small country. We can't change the world. We only account for... What was it, like 0.3% of the world's pollution, climate pollution or something, but
don't we all like to be rowing 0.03%
of, yeah, well, we're doing way more, like, per capita we are, yeah, huge emitters, but like they're like, but in real numbers we're not. But that was one argument. But then they completely undermined it by supporting the Libs going out there and campaigning hard in all the global summits against action on climate change by bigger countries. So we were punching above our weight in causing climate damage.
Because they were trying to... Everyone's concern was, we're going to fall behind. And they're like, no, we're telling them not to do it either.
Yes.
Oh my God.
So we don't need to do anything about it because we're really small. But also, let's discourage the rest of the world from doing anything about it too. We shouldn't do anything until they do. Also, guys, please don't do anything.
Oh, it's just mind-blowing. This topic will be in Australia versus humanity until the world ends, because we're past the point of no return. Like, at this point, we're just... Oh, God, we're fucked.
All right, so you're not going to believe me now, but another positive thing happened this week. This one's actually positive.
Is it?
Believe me.
Okay.
Believe me.
Oh, God.
Believe me. No, he's...
You said believe me.
I know.
Oh, God, it's going to be terrible.
No, it isn't actually. It's actually a good one. Northern Territory decriminalised abortion.
It's an actual positive story.
It is. So after the complete schmozzle that happened in Queensland trying to do it, the Northern Territory just did it. Like, sneakily, without telling us they were going to do it. Well, maybe they did tell people in the Northern Territory. I didn't know it was coming. It just happened.
Well, I mean, I'm sure the Northern Territory was putting something about a crocodile on the front of their paper, which is...
Oh, my God. What did the NT News do about it?
Oh, my God.
I wonder what their cover was. But I'm not going to look it up. Because I don't know how.
It's too much effort. No, this is a really positive thing. And, you know, I think people don't realise that some of these things still exist in Australia.
The abortion's criminalised in a whole lot of places.
Yeah. People don't know that. I was having this conversation at work today. And someone was like, is abortion illegal in the Northern Territory? I'm like, well, it's not now.
Wow. And it's weird. And there are places where it's not technically illegal, but it's really hard to access.
Exactly. And the illegality of it is all about reducing access, you know, getting your referral to someone who will do it, and it has to be under particular conditions. And
doctors have to refer you to, if people have conscientious objections, they have to, in Northern Territory, they'll now have to refer you to somebody who will actually provide it. It's fantastic. Like, it looks like it. I'm not sure what the flaws are. I'm terrified that if I miss something, but from July 1, Territory women will be able to access... they're hoping to be able to access RU486, but it will decriminalise surgical abortions, it will make medical abortions legal. So it's gone from... The Territory had some of the most outdated abortion laws in the country to some of the best. I'm trying to find the link where it was about them having to... Like, the doctors can't even... This, I love this thing. This is a Christian thing too, where freedom... Because they do it in the marriage equality debate as well. It's like their freedom of conscience to tell other people how to live their lives.
Mm.
That trumps other people having the freedom to live their lives. Oh. And they do that with doctors in abortion. Like, why, not the doctor is forced to do the abortion, but they want the right to have the doctor able to stop the woman going and finding somebody who will do the abortion. And that's not happening in the Northern Territory. So
which
exciting.
Is insane. Like, it's... No one's forcing you to do anything, but do you want... Your conscientious objection cannot extend as far as blocking someone from from finding someone who can do it.
No.
You just have to say, I don't do this. Barry down the road does it. There you go.
So all I'm saying is, Northern Territory... Now, you've got to hold the glass at the bottom for it to be... it's not going to have to be resonate. Oh, God, no. That's more like...
There we go. That's going to be the worst sound on a podcast. Everyone's going to rip their headphones
oh,
out.
Oh, shit. I didn't think of that. All right, sorry. No, I was wrong. The way to go on the podcast is...
There we go.
Okay, fine. All right, so let's have Tom Ballard...
We have to plug the Brewery Street Playground.
No, we don't.
Yes, we do.
Why?
Because you keep trying to stop it from happening, so I just felt like I had to do it.
Right. That is the podcast that former host of Something Wonky Dave Gorkroger does, and sometimes host of Well May We Say. Yes, he has a podcast called The Brewery Street Playground.
I think it's been mentioned in every single episode since...
No, I've been expressly banning it from being mentioned, so...
I know, that's why I did it.
No, well, you don't even think about shoving it in your Stuck in My Craw next week. He has a podcast, yes, where he and Steve Mogg talk about things. It's lovely and friendly.
It is very friendly.
And they don't talk about the depressing things that we talk about. But we're talking about good stuff right now.
We are.
And here Tom Ballard will be talking about another one.
Another good thing.
Here he is now.
Hello, World Maybe Says. It's Tom Ballard here with Stuck in My Craw. And I don't know if this counts, but I have good news. Can you have good news stuck in your craw? Well, I do. Although it has been a shitty week across the board for Australian politics for a range of reasons, which no doubt Jeremy and his guests will be covering on the episode that you've just heard, I have some good news. I played a very, very small part in a big old campaign to get the gay panic defence abolished from Queensland law. And this week, ICAD report that the government bloody listened and got it done. Gay panic is part of a partial defence for murder, and the thinking goes that if a gay person, particularly a gay man, were to come onto you, the gay panic that that might instill in you, awaken inside your homophobic soul, that could go in some way to explaining and justifying the fact that you killed that person. Under the law, under the gay panic defence, the death of a gay person was a lesser crime than killing a straight person, because, as we all know, those homosexuals are just no good at all. It's clearly outdated, anachronistic, and deeply homophobic, a relic of institutionalised homophobia that was still on the books in Queensland, and Father Paul Kelly, a Catholic priest, led the charge to have it changed. In his church in 2008, a man called Wayne Rux was killed by two men. And apparently, in their defence, his killers, James Pierce and Richard Meerdink, argued that Wayne Rux had made some kind of homosexual pass at Pierce. And they proceeded to run after him, tackle him to the ground, and then kick and punch him for several minutes. While he was on the ground, he eventually died of internal bleeding. Now, Wayne Rux wasn't even gay. And those arguments about the homosexual pass weren't found to be ultimately convincing by the judge in that case. But those two men went in for manslaughter, not murder. One of them's already out, and the other's up for parole pretty soon, having served just 9 years. So Paul Kelly was the priest in the church where Wayne Rox's body was found. He found out about the law and found it horrific, and he started a change.org petition, which now more than 270,000 people have signed. He also teamed up with Joyce Kujala, Wayne's mother, and a bunch of other high-profile allies, queer people and allies, coming together and saying, this law is absolute bullshit. How can this possibly still exist in 2017? And this week, the Queensland government listened to those calls, finally, and abolished the gay panic defence from Queensland law. Woohoo! Good news, right? A few things that suck in my craw about this. It should not have existed in the first place. It should not have taken this long. And the decision was delayed again and again by politicians on both sides. And you would hope the politicians would be able to get off their ass pretty easily and pass this piece of nonsense legislation. Also, what is still stuck in my craw is the fact that the gay panic defence is still on the books in South Australia. Andrew Neger died in Hallett Cove, South Australia, in April of 2011. He was stabbed more than 25 times before his body was dumped in a nearby reserve. In 2013, a Supreme Court found a man named Michael Lindsay. They found him guilty of bashing and stabbing Neger, and he was sentenced to a minimum of 23 years in prison. Lindsay's co-accused, Luke Hutchings, was found guilty of assisting Lindsay and was sentenced to 7 years behind bars. But during the case, the prosecution mentioned this detail, that Andrew Negri made a comment to Lindsay with a sexual connotation, something like, I'll pay you for sex. Lindsay appealed, and that series of appeals brought him to the High Court. The court quashed his conviction and ordered a retrial take place, because in the court's opinion, there was sufficient evidence for Lindsay to argue that he'd been provoked by Negri's alleged homosexual advance. Now, eventually, in that retrial, the verdict was again murder, thank goodness. But the gay panic argument and defence was there, and it is still on the books in South Australia. And murderers could have their convictions reduced to manslaughter. It's a travesty of justice, and it's an example of still the kind of bigotry that's evident in our law to this day. What else is stuck in my craw is the absolute cynicism surrounding quote-unquote clicktivism. Now, yes, we all do a lot of complaining online without following it up with any serious action, and that's no good. We could all afford to do more, get more involved, write our MPs more, sign more petitions, lobby for more change more actively. But let's not pretend that change.org petitions don't have effects. Particularly when you get 270,000 people signing them, you can actually bring about change. Politicians do actually listen to that shit sometimes. So you can be cynical all you want, But if you can follow Father Paul Kelly's example and Joyce's example and bring together a broad coalition of people who all care about the same thing, bring them together and keep up the pressure. Father Kelly's campaign lasted for more than 5 years, keep in mind, to finally get this change through this week. You can get shit done. So my message to the homophobes is piss off, please. We're going to overturn these shitty laws. Don't you worry about that. Even after, you know, same-sex marriage is eventually passed, there are still these legal battles to win. And also, to cool progressive people who listen to this podcast, don't give up hope in actions like these. We can get shit done, and the abolition of the Gay Panic Defence proves that.
Thank you, Tom, for supporting the kind of things that everybody listening to this podcast is actually doing, even when we don't necessarily go the next step. Although we should go the next step as well, but it's nice to think that it's not, you know, all completely wasted, or that if we, you know, each week might record a podcast, a short punchy podcast, it's still got, you know, it's certainly not one that like sort of goes on longer than anticipated because we go off on tangents.
Yes. Tom makes an amazing point. I think collectivism actually does have a purpose. It serves a function. It's a way of using technology, and everyone's talking about using technology to achieve change. That this law took over 200,000 people signing up, that it took 5 years, like, it should have been, hey, did you know that you have a gay panic law? And the government saying, oh god, no, we shouldn't have that, and then getting rid of it. It's insane to me that wasn't the process of getting rid of this, and it didn't happen in 2 seconds. But that's what it takes. It takes 200 and something thousand people signing a petition.
So obviously the South Australia one still needs changing, but it looks like Father Kelly's petition, the change.org petition that I think is the one that Tom was talking about, is now petitioning the Premier of South Australia. So if you have a look on change.org, and I'll put a link up for the petition, which is called Stop Allowing Gay Panic as an Excuse for Murder in Australia. It looks like the way that it is still a defence or partial defence in South Australia is through the common law. So they still have provocation. Now, there's other reasons to get rid of provocation that aren't anything to do with LGBTI people. And the gay panic defence is obviously was in the case that Tom was talking about, doesn't just affect LGBTI people, because also, like, it's a defence for murderers to say, oh yeah, he made a pass at me, which, hard for you to prove from beyond the grave.
Yeah, absolutely.
You may, like, it doesn't have to be true. Like, it's not, but provocation is problematic, and there's a reason why a lot of states have got rid of provocation as a defence. So the problem with provocation is it's a very gendered defence. It was used primarily by men who killed their wives or their girlfriends, and it was stuff like, I caught her having an affair, or I found out she had an affair, and that's why I lost my mind. I went, I killed her in a jealous rage, and that reduced murder down to manslaughter, because, oh, okay, he was out of his mind. He just discovered that his wife was having an affair. What else could he do? Like, it was an obnoxious thing to be using to minimize the seriousness of criminal offense. Whereas when women killed their husbands, it tended to be after many years of abuse, you know, stabbing him in the night, or like, it tended to be the kind of thing that didn't count as provocation, because it seemed cold-blooded. Where in fact, you know, somebody snapping after a long period of time. Mm. But because of the relative disparity in body size and ability to kill somebody, you know, just by applying physical force whenever he's awake and alert, it tended to be that men were able to kill women and get off using provocation, and women killing men tended not to be able to. And used to be lots of research on this, and I remember looking at law school in like the 90s about provocation, when that was still at uni. I remember addressing it, and then Victoria eventually changed it. So if South Australia, it sounds like in South Australia, it doesn't actually say, and I haven't looked up the legislation, but I'm just looking at the petition. The petition seems to say that it is through, when they say it's the common law interpretation of the partial defence of provocation. And what that means is that there is case law that says that a gay person cracking onto you is considered provocation.
Mm.
So I think the legislation will say have the provocation defence, and then...
Yeah.
So
it's a less specific defence that exists compared to Queensland, which...
But the common law says that it's still there. So you need the parliament to expressly exclude it.
Mm.
And then it's no longer part of the common law, because the legislation has changed.
Yes.
And you can no longer interpret provocation that way. But I think that the best thing to do would be to get rid of provocation entirely. The problem with that, of course, is that it means that it's a slightly slower process, because it's a bigger change to get rid of provocation than it is to just get rid of the gay panic aspect of it.
Do you think there's merit in trying to get rid of the gay panic aspect and then making the provocation thing a longer term goal, or do you think it needs to all be...
Given how slow it is making these changes at all, I think you probably need to do them at once, but I think they need to do it fairly promptly, and I don't think it... I don't see why it's the sort of thing that the Liberal government couldn't get done before the election next year. Like, it's they could get that locked in. They're probably going to lose because of the length of time that Labor's been in South Australia. And because the federal government's been effective at demonising the South Australian government and blaming them for the blackout. And people just see that the lights didn't work and it was in South Australia and not anywhere else, so they'll blame the state government. I think that, I don't know, I think it's one of those things where they're on borrowed time and there's not much that they can do about it. So, but they could shove that in quickly before the Conservatives get there and fix it. Actually, to be fair to the Conservatives, there is one other thing that's happening this week. Sarah Henderson, who's a Liberal MP, is busy running a campaign to address some of the problems in domestic violence, the way family violence and the way it's dealt with in the family law. And one of them is this, I think I've talked about it on the podcast before, the problem you've got where... I'm sure I've talked about it on the podcast before, where an alleged perpetrator of family violence doesn't have a lawyer, and he then gets to cross-examine his victim in the witness box in the family law proceedings.
Which is insane.
Yes. Because, but it makes sense because he's his own lawyer at that point, and if she's giving evidence, you need to, the other side needs to cross-examine it. That's how you test evidence. So at the moment, that can happen. And does happen. And so there is a campaign now for an inquiry or a commission to review those sorts of things, and particularly that one, and get that one changed. In Victoria, as I think I've said on the podcast before, that's already different in terms of intervention orders. So if an abuser is representing himself, or an alleged abuser is representing himself, obviously his accuser still needs to be cross-examined, but there is legal aid is actually directed by the court to appoint a barrister just to do the cross-examination if somebody's self-represented, and they are forbidden for doing the cross-examination themselves, which is, it's a weird situation, but there's at least something in place to protect the victims in that case. So that does need to happen federally. So, look, these sorts of things, the provocation defence thing and the gay panic defence, it may be something the Conservative government could in fact do. I suspect probably not, because one of the side effects of the fact that the Libs have turned marriage equality into a big political issue between them and Labor, to the point where, like, they're really resentful about the Liberal moderates are really resentful that the CEO's got involved because it stopped them doing the softly softly thing. I think the Libs are now hostile enough to LGBTI people that they probably aren't. Maybe 10 years ago I'd have some confidence they would. That's the sort of thing they might come in and change. Now I think that people in the conservative side of politics have sort of hardened against LGBTI people whilst the community's moved on. And so I don't think they will. I guess my message here is Weatherall, you need to do something about it now. And can we all sign the petition to put pressure on him to do so?
Yeah. I think conservatives could do it. And I don't doubt that this could be achieved by either side of politics.
Yeah.
My concern is that the LGBTI voice is becoming less and less heard on the conservative side of politics. So this becomes less of a priority because this voice they've associated with something negative, and therefore they've tuned it out. So when LGBTI people are saying you need to remove this thing because it's awful and stupid and I can't believe it exists, they're so busy being hung up on all of the other topics that we're criticising them on, which we're rightfully criticising them on, that they ignore this thing as well, because it just gets lumped in. It's just another LGBTI issue, and they have tuned our community out in a lot of ways because...
Well, maybe it's because maybe the LGBTI people or community are also tuning out the Libs. There's only so long you can... Like, there was a point at which they thought, okay, it's going to get done, and then it didn't get done, and it's dragging out. And there must be a lot of LGBTI people who are like, ah... Oh, you know what?
The it's going to get done thing was 10 years ago.
Yeah, I'm over the Conservatives now. This is getting ridiculous. Like, just do it.
You know Facebook memories?
Yeah.
I get Facebook memories from 8 years ago. Like, this is it. Marriage equality is going to happen. And then it doesn't. That was 8 years ago.
I remember going to marriage equality rallies in the early 2000s, yeah. Like, with my first wife. Like, and we're like, it's got to be coming now. What? There's, look, they're,
we could go on forever.
These are topics that have, like, it's weird because they're both things that are straightforward and should really just be happening, and yet they're not, and it's not happening. These things, I guess, it's just a slow process of hoping they percolate through people's brain. I don't know. I mean, obviously, the people who are listening to this podcast are presumably on board with it.
You could please have some hate listeners.
I tried hate listening to other podcasts. I don't think it's good for your soul. I feel that we needed to address these things this week because they are still current issues, and the fact that the CEOs came up and were sort of slapped down in that way, and the fact that the Conservatives are really resentful about this issue being brought up as a distraction. They see it as a distraction. I think it's still something we've got to talk about and just bat back the silly arguments that they come up with, because it hasn't gone away, and the anti-equality people are really organised, and they are getting heard.
They're incredibly engaged and passionate, and as a community, the LGBTI community has to bank people who have no stake in this be engaged and passionate, and that's the challenge. Sustaining that is the challenge.
But I would also say I think there's a lot in the LGBTI community who are giving up on marriage, and they're like, not giving up on marriage as an idea, but saying, like, I'm sick of the issue, like, it's a distraction.
Oh yeah.
And I think that anybody listening to this from the LGBTI community or from any community needs to remember that this is not about marriage; it's about equality before the law,
yeah.
And that, so it's more fundamental to LGBTI people and kids growing up and who are LGBTI. It's a profound and fundamental issue because it's about equality before the law, and the secondary issue is not just equality before the law, it's being recognised as equal people. Mm. Because the argument against it is people who don't want to treat LGBTI people as equal.
Yeah.
That's why they're so hit up about it. That's what their argument is, because deep down they don't believe you're equal.
And if you ever question it, look at the other things those people are saying.
Yeah. All right, well, let's wrap it up there. Welcome to all our new listeners. Thank you to all of you who've come back. Thank you to everyone who's promoted us on Twitter. Huge thanks to our Patreon subscribers and anyone who'd like to give us a 5-star review on iTunes so that other people can find us. Thank you to my co-host for tonight, Damien O'Mara.
Thank you for having me on.
Our Stuck in My Craw contributor, returning Tom Ballard. Our beloved editor, Daniel Karma. Robin Gray for the music. Alex Lum for the artwork. Thank you for joining us for this, very punchy short episode. And we'll see you all next week. Good night.
Thank you.